really do, I whisper back. I slip into Ave Maria, my favorite song as a child, the first one I ever played on stage when I was 4. Ix's hands stop everything, and the room, though filled with music, goes still. I close my eyes as my body moves, and he begins again, the song powerful, but what's happening between us even more so. His fingertips slide up and down my ribs, soft, sweeping motions that send a chill up my neck and come out in the notes that float in the air. God, he whispers, his touch wandering down to the curve of my hips, my legs part, like he commanded them to. But really, it's nothing more than my own invitation, which he accepts by parting the lips of my pussy, finding the wetness accumulating just for him, and begins to play me like I'm playing the violin.
Chapter 42 Ixion. I can't stop myself. The beauty in this room is overwhelming. Not just the song she's playing. It's not just Ave Maria coming from the soul of one of the world's most talented violinists. It's her, too. Her sweet face, her innocence, her large, soft breasts, the shape of her waist and hips, and the tickling touches of her long hair as it brushes across my arms as she gives me what I wanted since the first time I met her. I just didn't realize it. Herself, with no expectations, blind and willing. Her pussy is wet, her clit swelling under my touch the same way my cock is now filled with longing. Her legs open wider, the weight of her body on my legs silently driving me wild. I can't wait any longer. Reluctantly, I take my touch from her to me, open my belt, open my pants, and fist my cock as I pull it out. She shivers, like she knows what I'm doing even though she's blind. Yes, she murmurs. I don't need her encouragement, but I do like it. Leaning back into the cushions to get a better view forces her to shift her weight. I pump one hand up and down my cock as the other returns to her open and exposed pussy. If she could only see herself. How beautiful she is. How perfect. If ever there was a moment that needed to be caught on film, this is it. But a wave of regret washes over me, because no latent image could ever capture the stunning brilliance of her in real time. She turns her back to me, but not in a dismissive way, because she edges her ass up my lap until my cock is between her legs. She lifts her hips, her fingers still playing the soundtrack to the lust building inside us. She hovers over me, her pussy rubbing against the tip of my cock. I can't wait any longer. She's urging me to take her, and I just want to please in this moment. I want nothing more than to give her what she wants. My cock slips inside her, but she pulls back, looking over her shoulder, and stops playing. No, she whispers. I've had that before. Take me in a new way, X. Be the first ever to take me in that way. I have to blink several times as the realization of what she's asking for manifests. Her ass. She wants me to fuck her in the ass. Are you sure? I ask, my voice thick with husk and growl, betraying the hunger inside me. Yes, she says. Yes. And stand up, I say. She obeys, resumes playing the soft, slow song as she rises off my lap. I kick her legs wide, her bow still sliding across the strings, and then sink to my knees, pull her ass cheeks apart, and lick her. My fingers drag the now pooling readiness from her pussy to her asshole, and I slowly stick my finger in. She never stops playing, but she whines and grunts, and when my finger is all the way inside her, she whimpers, "More." She is so wet now, so eager for what's coming next, that her asshole is well primed when I sit back in the chair, place her on my lap, and press my cock up against her tight muscles. Her music turns wild and frantic, her bow skipping across the strings, her fingers jumping on the neck. And then I enter her. She moans, a whimpering moan that's equal parts pain and pleasure. I hike her legs open, totally exposing her, and pull her back into my chest, my hands cupping her perfect round breasts, and squeeze them, just as she clenches her muscles and squeezes me back. Dying. I am dying of pleasure. I close my eyes, let my hands wander back between her legs, strumming her clit as she becomes more comfortable with my cock inside her ass, and begins to move. Just a little. Just enough to drive me crazy. One hand goes to her hip, urging her to fuck me harder, urging her to let me even deeper inside her while my fingers push up inside her pussy, stretching her wide from both ends. Oh my God, she moans. And she never stops playing. I want to see you, I say, urging her to turn around. And I want you to see me. Take off the fucking blindfold. No, she says, her song slow again. No, not yet. So I have to settle. I have to settle for fucking her in the ass, her back to me, her song filling my ears, her long hair teasing my chest as it lightly crashes onto my skin like feathers in a windstorm. But there are worse ways to settle. Come, I say, my thumb finding her slit as I push my fingers deeper. Come on my fingers right now. She lets out one long breath, her body stiff for a moment, her bow stuck midair, her fingers still, and then she melts into me. Gushing relief spills out of her, coats my fingers, spilling past them, and drips down onto my cock. I have to bite my fucking lip to stop my own climax. She falls forward, drops the violin on the floor, and places her hands on my knees as she pants through the waves of pleasure that overtake her body. I make myself wait. It can't end yet. I'm not ready. She takes all the decisions away from me when she stands up, my cock slipping out of her ass, and then turns around, gets on her knees between my legs, takes my cock in her hand, and lowers her mouth to it. No hesitation, no overthinking, no resistance at all. Willing to lose herself in the moment, willing to do anything and everything to keep this dream going. I die over and over again as she licks my tip, wraps her lips around my swollen head, and then pushes my cock deep into her throat. There's no way I can't come, no chance I won't explode. I grab her hair, guiding her mouth, pushing her down onto my cock until her nose is almost flat against my stomach. She gags, gasps for breath, and then tilts her head up like she's looking me in the eyes. I want to rip that blindfold off and see her. Really fucking see her. But she's reading my mind, or maybe she's telling me no. She can't continue like this. I'm suffocating her with my cock because she shakes her head. I lift her face off me and cum all over her mouth. Her hands crash onto my chest, pulling at my t-shirt, clawing her way up my body until she's sitting on my lap again, her legs straddling mine, and she kisses me on the mouth. I kiss her back, long and hard, and desperate. I hold her face, and she says, "Not yet." When I think, "Take off that fucking blindfold." "Not yet." "If not tonight, if not now, then when?" I say, "When?" She just shakes her head again, her body becoming soft, and then slips off to the side, pulling me over with her until we're nestled up to each other, her ass pushing against my cock, her back pushing into my chest, like we're a couple. I smile, because tonight, we are. We sleep. I'm not sure how long, because it's still dark outside, and I pick her up in my arms and carry her up to her bedroom. She moans, and even though that stupid blindfold slips off her eyes, she never opens them. It's like she's afraid to see me. Which is perfect, right? Just fucking perfect. Because I am desperate for her to see me. I am desperate to be seen, and she wants to keep me invisible. Once she's settled in bed, I kiss her on the lips. She wakes just long enough to kiss me back, her fingertips threading into my hair, grabbing me, making me feel wanted, and then lets go, rolls over, and sleeps. I reluctantly leave her, go downstairs, find our book, and begin to write the end I started and couldn't finish. Because this is it. Our stories have been told. Her fear has been banished, and my job here is done. I leave our book on the kitchen counter where she expects it to be, then take myself back downstairs, enter the secret room, and stare at the ceiling until the sun comes up.
Chapter 43. Evangeline. I wake up smiling even before I remember why I'm smiling. How have I only been here 6 days? This feels like my life now. Like everything I was doing before I came to this house with Ix. God, I'm still getting used to that. Was fake. A dream. Or some kind of alternate reality. And now this is reality. I'm awake, and I might even be happy. I get up, throw on my nightgown and robe, run down the stairs, and I'm just about to walk into the kitchen to get our book when a loud chime fills the house. I whirl around and stare at the hallway leading to the grand foyer. It's the doorbell, I realize. I travel the hallway on tiptoe, which is stupid because I'm barefoot and still in my nightgown, and peek around the corner like a child who is supposed to be in bed. There's someone on the other side of the wavy, leaded glass in the front door. The bell rings again, so I tiptoe closer. I'm almost certain whoever is on the other side can see me, so I take a deep breath, clutch my silk robe around my body, and open it. "Evangeline Rolaine?" the man asks. He's wearing the tidy blue uniform suit of a well-known local delivery service. "That's me," I say, surprised I have a voice. Surprised I even opened the door, now that I think about it. I'm very exposed. No scarf, no gloves, no hat, no sunglasses. "Sign here, please," he says, thrusting a tablet at me. I sign with my finger, then hand it back as another man comes up the front walkway with several large packages.
"Would you like us to bring them inside?" the first man asks.
I nod, trying to understand what's happening, and then move out of the way so they can enter the foyer. "Here is fine," I say, pointing to the exquisitely upholstered bench under the mirror. "And I'm sorry, but I don't have my purse."
"No need,"
the second man says, arranging the packages neatly on and around the bench. He smiles at me.
"The tip has already been taken care of."
"Who's this from?" I ask. The first man says,
"There's a card, ma'am. Do you need anything from us?"
"What would I need?" I ask, genuinely curious.
"We were instructed to ask if you required anything, ma'am."
"No, thank you," I say. "I'm good." They both bow their heads at me as they back out, closing the front door behind them. How strange. I walk over to the packages. There's about half a dozen, each with a small card attached to the bow, and each card has a number on it, 1 through 6. They are all different sizes. 1 is the size of a large shoebox, 3 are the size of my hand, 1 is very large, at least 3 feet long and very wide, like it contains a whole other world under that paper and ribbon. The last one is very thin and flat, and they are all wrapped up in matte black paper, adorned with yards of golden fabric ribbon, and each has an elaborate golden bow. 1, the largest box, has a regular-sized card attached to it, as well as the smaller one with the number. I pluck the card off the paper. It comes off easily, like special care was taken so the paper wouldn't rip, and open it up. "Dear Evangeline, today is the day you break free. Don't be afraid of going after what you want. You deserve the world, and the world deserves you. Unwrap the packages numbered 1 through 4. Don't open the last 2. Those are for later. I won't be watching today. A car will come to collect you at exactly 11:30. You will be dropped off. You will go inside and satisfy your curiosity however you see fit, and then you will return home in the same car. Ix." I'm holding my breath. I don't realize it until I let it out in a gush of air and feel a little dizzy. Alone. I am to go out today alone. Is it much different than yesterday when I left here without instructions?
Yes, it's very different.
I don't know why, but it is. And for a few seconds I allow my heart to beat fast. I allow the sweat to form on my brow. I allow my hands to shake and my legs to tremble. And then I look up at the chandelier and say, "Okay."
I walk over to the gifts, lay the box marked 1 down onto the foyer rug, and kneel. My fingers can't help but feel the rich golden ribbon. It's not smooth satin, but has a raised damask pattern woven into the silk. Very special, I realize, and very expensive. I pull on it, expecting it to resist, but it doesn't. The knot falls apart easily, like it was meant to do that, and soon it's just a puddle of gold near my knees. The box has a lid meant to lift off, again without resistance, and when I lift it, there is a swoosh of air which makes the black and gold tissue paper inside puff up with a display of splendorous pageantry. My fingers are eager now, pulling the delicate paper aside to reveal a dress.
"Oh my," I sigh, lifting the dress out of the paper so I can hold it up to the light filtering in from the high arched windows above the door. It's white. Winter white. Not summer wedding dress white. Almost cream. And it's clearly cashmere because it's so soft my fingertips want to pet it. I stand up, holding it against my body. It's been tailored to my shape, because even though the skirt is long, it's not too long. I shrug off my robe, slip out of my silk nightgown, and step into it, just to make sure. And even though the bodice is low cut, it's not too low cut. My breasts fill up the cups on either side of the V down the middle, and make a spectacular show of cleavage. The A-line waist hits me just above my hips, and the hem swings just above my calves. The intercom crackles just once, letting me know he's watching. I twirl for him, laughing, feeling like a child again. I had so many pretty, pretty dresses as a child. I wore them to spectacular places. For a moment, I'm disappointed that my destination today is the coffee house. This dress was meant to take me somewhere spectacular. The halls of a palace, or the desert gardens of a sheikh in winter. But I remember there's more inside the box. So I rush over and pull out a winter coat. Tan. The perfect color to complement the winter white dress. Double-breasted with large black buttons, a wide belt, and brown faux fur trim on the hood and cuffs. It's A-line, like the dress, with a long loose ruffle just above the waist for added flair. Underneath the coat are tan leather gloves, which makes me laugh, because I left mine in the cab yesterday, and even though I'm not sure if I care about exposing my hands, I will surely need gloves to leave the house on such a cold winter day. There's a scarf, too, but not a thick one to cover my face like I usually wear. Silk. Cream, with an intricate tan pattern. There's even a new pair of sunglasses. Not big and round and meant for hiding, but sheer and sleek and chic. The second box contains over-the-knee suede boots the same color as the coat. Heels high enough to make me worry, but I dismiss that fear. I'm done with fear. There's more to unwrap. It's like Christmas, and I feel like I'm young again. I go back over to the bench, find the package marked 3, and sit back down on the rug to open it. The skirt of the dress pulls around me like a puddle of snow. The ribbon gives in as I tug, just like on the other boxes. And when I open the lid on this one, there is a necklace. I can't stop the huff of surprise that escapes my lips, because this is no ordinary necklace. It's diamonds and sapphires intricately woven together on a strand of silver, or white gold or platinum, that would make a queen feel special. "Oh, Ix," I whisper. I shake my head. "Too nice for a coffee house." The crackle of the intercom urges me to keep going, so I lay the box aside, get up to get number 4, and sit back down in a pile of ribbon that looks like spun gold. The 4th gift is earrings to match the necklace. He bought me an entire outfit, and it's perfect. It's me. So very, very me. I didn't even know who I was before coming to this house with Ix. But these clothes on my body add up to the image I've always wanted for myself. no longer the child prodigy, but a grown, competent woman. I daydream about how gorgeous I will look wearing this ensemble. What time is it? I get up, rush to the kitchen to find the clock, and realize I only have an hour before the car will come collect me. I shower, blow-dry my hair, and lightly apply a little makeup. Not too much. Today, I don't want to hide. I want to be me. I put the dress back on, slip the boots up my legs with a sigh, and fasten the necklace around my neck and the earrings on my ears. For the next 10 minutes, I just stare at myself in the mirror, amazed at how different I look. How well I have grown up. How beautiful I am, even without the violin. Do you think I'm pretty? I ask the camera above the bed. I think I'm going to like you, Ix, when I finally meet you properly. I think I'm going to like you a lot. The door chime pulls me away from my own reflection. I put the coat on, fasten the wide belt at my waist, pull the gloves over my hands, put on my sunglasses, and walk downstairs, ready for this day to begin. The driver is at the door wearing a dark suit and dark sunglasses. He says, "Good morning, ma'am," as he extends his forearm. I take it, unafraid, and let him walk me to the car, open my door, and hold my hand as I slip into the back seat that smells like rich leather and honey. There's tea set on the console between the two luxurious leather seats, a small pot made of white china, one cup, a tiny dish filled with golden honey, and an equally tiny honey dipper sits off to the side. I decide why not indulge. It's been so long since I had this kind of luxury in my life. Luxury I could afford to enjoy. Luxury I felt I deserved. So I pour a cup of tea, drip long, viscous strands of honey into the amber liquid, and sip, fully content in the stillness of the smooth ride as we make our way through downtown. We stop and I look out, surprised. "Where are we?" I ask the driver.
"This was the destination, ma'am."
He gets out, opens my door, and holds out his hand to help me out. He says,
"I was told to give you this note."
For some reason, the small folded piece of white paper in his hand makes my stomach clench up with fear. "What does it say?" I ask.
"I don't know, ma'am."
I take it, and he says,
"The car will be here when you're ready to leave."
I look up and realize we're parked in front of what might be a hotel valet area. There's a large revolving door, but no sign above. It looks empty. "Is this?"
"No, ma'am," the driver says. "There."
He points to the shop next door that does have a sign, which reads, "The Tea Room." And then he bows his head a little and walks back around to the driver's side and gets into the car. I'm alone. Again. And I don't like it. Hesitantly, I open the folded note and read. "Evangeline, go into the tea room and tell the hostess you're looking for Jordan Wells. She'll tell you where to go next. Ix." I don't think I want to do this. Something inside me is screaming no. A gut feeling that whatever is waiting for me inside that shop, it's not what I'm looking for. But I came all this way. All the way from frightened girl to confident woman. And I don't want to run away now. I don't want my future to slip through my fingertips. I don't want to go back into the past. So I draw in a deep breath, walk over to the door, open it up, and step into the tea room. Inside, it's quaint. Lots of tables, mostly full of chatting women sitting in overstuffed chairs. It's bright, far brighter than any room I'd have been caught alive in 1 week ago, and smells delicious, like fresh baked goods and summer afternoons. "Ms. Rolaine?" I turn my head to find a tall woman with long dark hair, about my age, looking at me with an air of familiarity. "Yes," I say. "I'm Evangeline Rolaine." I don't think I've introduced myself to anyone in public since I was 14. Managing it excites me, because it's a huge step forward. But it also scares me. Why does she know my name? "They're waiting for you back here." She smiles and turns, her long hair swishing from the quick movement. "They?" I ask, but she's steps ahead of me now, so I feel like the only thing I can do is follow. I'm very glad Ix left me the sunglasses. And I'm also extremely happy that they're not the large, dark, round ones I used to wear, because these don't look like sunglasses you have to take off indoors, and those did. I leave them on as I maneuver my way through tables and people until we reach a set of double doors at the back. The panic sets in as she reaches for both doorknobs and pulls them open to reveal a man, standing tall and sitting in the middle of the room, hands clasped in front of his body, uncertain smile on his face. But I have no idea who the man on the other side of the door is. What's going on? Oh, my. Evangeline! I turn to see Dr. Lucinda Chatwell off to my left, walking towards me with her arms outstretched. You look so different, so beautiful. She pulls me into her, grabbing both my hands and kissing me on the cheek as I awkwardly embrace her back. What's going on? I ask again. Who's this? I ask, motioning to the man in the room. This is my partner. Ixion said you were ready to leave the house and you wanted to meet Jordan before you left. What? I shake my head and blink my eyes, like I'm dreaming and just need to wake up. This isn't Jordan. I know him. I've been watching him all week, in the gardens next to the house and at the coffee house for lunch. What? They say it at the same time. Jordan, this isn't... What are you talking about? Lucinda asks. This is Jordan Wells, my partner. He's the one who found Ixion. That's the name of your watcher, Ixion Veneer. When he called me last night, he said... He called you last night? I ask. And he set this up? Yes, Lucinda says. What's wrong? Why... I tune her out as all the puzzle pieces fall into place. X. Ix. Ixion, my watcher, my stranger. He was the one meeting me all week. It was him in the greenhouse. It was him in the coffee house. It was him the whole time. Where is he? I ask. Who? Lucinda asks. Jordan just stands there looking as confused as I feel. Ixion, I say, trying out his name. He wanted me to look at him last night. He wanted me to see him, and I said no. I wanted to stay blind. I have to go, I say, rushing back the way I came. The woman who took me to the private tea room is blocking my way, also wearing an expression of confusion on her face. I push past, then weave through the tables and people, all the while Lucinda is calling my name. But I don't turn back, and I'm not running away either. I'm running towards something. Ixion. This is why I had such a bad feeling all morning. No, 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 no. I push through the front door and run to the car. Lucinda follows me out, calling my name, but I slip into the back seat and tell the driver, "Take me home right now, quickly, quick!" I say it again when he looks at me in confusion. Lucinda opens the door, but I put up a hand and stop her from getting in. "No," I say. "This is not over yet." And then I push her back, close the door back up, and lean into the front seat. Drive! Now! I chew my lip as we weave our way through downtown traffic, the familiar gut-wrenching, all-too-familiar fear I've known for the past 10 years overtaking me again. I need to get inside. I need his eyes on me. I need him. He can't leave me like this. He wouldn't. But when I get to the house and rush through the front door, the first thing I see is the missing bulb up in the chandelier. He's gone. I had a chance to know him, really know him, and I turned him down, and now he's gone.
You never told me the end of the story, I scream, whirling around, looking for more cameras.
That's when I see the last two gifts still sitting on the bench where I left them this morning. I sink to the floor in the grand foyer, the piles of golden silk ribbon surrounding me like a pond of summer. Tears welling up in my eyes. I don't want them, I say. I don't want presents. I don't need more clothes. I don't need jewelry. I don't need any of this stuff. I just want to talk to you. I'll take off the blindfold. I promise. I'm pleading now, begging to the empty air. And because he's gone, there's no reply. No crackle of the intercom to urge me on. No sense of his all-seeing stare. I am alone, unseen, unheard, hidden from the world. And it's ironic. After all those years of wanting to be invisible, right now I can think of nothing I want less. The front door is still open. The wind is whipping through the house, making me shake with cold, when a shadow falls onto the floor in front of me. I look up, hopeful, but see only Lucinda standing there, her body a silhouette of darkness against the bright winter sun. "What's going on?" she asks. "What happened here? Did he touch you? Did he hurt you?" I shake my head as a tear falls down my cheek. "No," I whisper. "He was gentle and good, and I want him back. Can you bring him back?" I see that Jordan, the real Jordan, has also come. He steps out from behind Lucinda and says,
"He left about an hour ago. Called me up and said the job was done. I should go to the tea room to meet with Lucinda and you, and that was it. He hung up. I tried to call him back after you ran out, but..."
He shakes his head.
"He won't answer."
"Where did he go?" I ask. "Where does he live? I need to find him." He shrugs.
"I don't know, Evangeline. Somewhere up in Wyoming, I think. I found him in jail a few weeks ago."
"You what?" Lucinda asks. "What the hell is wrong with you, Jordan? Why the hell did you hire a man who..."
"He's a friend, okay?"
"Then why don't you know where he lives?" I ask, getting to my feet. "If he's your friend, then where is he?" I yell that last part. "Is this part of your stupid game? Am I just another piece to play with?"
"Evangeline," Lucinda says in her stupid, calm doctor voice.
"No!" I scream. "No! You people put me here with him, and now you think you're going to take him away? No!"
"I'm sorry," Jordan says. "When Ix disappears, well, he just goes.
He's just gone." The three of us stand there, staring at each other. Lucinda looking like she really needs me to accept reality. Jordan looking guilty. About what, I don't know, but I want to find out. And me. God, me. I feel so alone. That word in my head makes me wilt. "I want to go home," I say in a soft, small voice that reminds me of the woman I was before I came here. "I want my apartment, with the curtains drawn, and the city far, far away."
"Why?" Jordan asks.
"Why what?" I snap.
"Why go back when you came this far? Ixion was never part of your future, Evangeline. He never was. He wasn't supposed to talk to you or whatever else he did,"
Jordan says, starting to put the pieces together.
"He broke the rules, okay? You need to forget about him. Believe me, he's forgotten about you. That's what he does best."
I seethe at that characterization of Ixion Vanir. I glare at Jordan, stare him straight in the eyes. Let him see me as I draw myself up, square my shoulders, lift my chin, and say, "You don't even know him. You don't even know me. But I know you," I say, pointing my finger at him. "He told me everything about you." Jordan shrinks back. "Yes," I say, nodding. "And if he left here, it was because of you, not me." We stare at each other for several seconds. I pull away first, and that's when I see the last two gifts. The one marked 5 is about the right size, and when I walk over and pick it up, it's the right weight, too.
"What's that?"
Lucinda asks. I glance at Jordan as I pull the ribbon apart, tear the paper off, and hold our book in my hands. "The end," I say. "This is the end I was waiting for." I grab the other gift, walk out of the house, get back into the still-waiting car, and give the driver my address. I don't open the book. I sit quietly as I'm taken back to my home. And when I walk through the front door of my building, I stare straight at the concierge and say, "Hello," as I pass. "I'm going to need you to let me in my apartment. I seem to have left my purse behind." He stares at me, then offers up a quick, "Hello, Miss Rolaine. I'm glad to see you again," as he pats his jacket for a key card and follows me to the elevator. "It's good to be home," I say, as the elevator door opens and we get inside together, the unopened present in one hand, the book in the other. And when the doors open, and when I'm let in, and the door is closed behind me, I walk to the couch, set the unopened gift down, and collapse into the cushions with the book in my hand. If I read it, it's going to be the end of everything. It's going to be the end of us. I open the book and turn to the page where we left off.
Chapter 44. Ixion. I was done. I enjoyed sex with Augustine, but it wasn't the sex that made me love her. I didn't need her body, just her mind. Likewise with Jordan. I wasn't in love with him. He's a good-looking man, and we had some fun, but I'm not interested in being in a relationship with a man. Besides, they didn't really need me. They fucked, and most of the time I just watched. Sat in the chair across the room, stroking myself as they went at it. And even that wasn't necessary. I wasn't necessary. Except it turns out I actually was. I was the glue that held them together. I was the necessary part that made their machine run. Augustine loved me the way I loved her. We were friends first, business partners second. Lovers came a very distant third in our relationship. Jordan is smart. He understands people. Most of the time better than they understand themselves. He had that advantage over us, I guess. He knew us better than we knew ourselves. When he came up with his plan, he knew she was longing for Alexander again. He knew I was done. He knew it was already over. But he also knew she loved me. Not him, but me. Not Alexander, but me. I was the glue that kept her and Jordan together. Alexander was the one who kept them apart. Jordan told me, "Wouldn't I like just one shot at her alone?" And he asked her, "Wouldn't she like me with her and only her? Just one night, just Ixion and Augustine. One night to do whatever we wanted, whatever our hearts told us to do." I was going to say no. I didn't expect her to say yes. But she did.
Chapter 45. Evangeline. It ends there? No, that can't be the end. That's not a fucking ending. What the hell, Ix? I stand up and the last package rolls on the couch cushion. It's too small to be another notebook, but I pull on the gold ribbon and tear at the black paper anyway, eager and hopeful that I will find the answers I was looking for. It's a phone. My phone with a new touchscreen. And there's a voicemail alert blinking at me. Ixion's voice is clear and calm when I press play. "Hey," he says. "Bet you're wondering what the fuck, right? What happened next?" He sighs. Silence for several seconds as he works through whatever's on his mind. "Me too," he finally says. "I think about it constantly now. I know what happened. I know what he did. I know what he didn't do. I know that most of what came next was just bad luck." He pauses again. My mind is racing with questions. "I took responsibility. Jordan was in law school, was about to graduate, about to take the bar exam and join his father back here in Colorado to carry the torch and all that bullshit. The point being, Jordan had a future. And yeah, I'd do anything for the guy back then. I loved him in my own way. He'd been my best friend since we were little kids. Partners in crime, we used to joke. Never knowing it'd really turn into that 20-some years later. You can't be a lawyer if you have a felony record. He didn't ask me to do it. I just felt compelled. I feel compelled a lot. It's why I am where I am, and it's partly my fault anyway. Because I lied to everyone. To Augustine, mostly. But everyone. So, fuck it, right? Fuck it. Bad choices lead to bad outcomes, and fuck it." He pauses again. Maybe to collect himself. Because I can hear the hard swallow like we're just inches apart. "You should stay away, Evangeline. Play your show. Live your life. And forget I ever happened. Trust me, it's for the best.
Chapter 46. Ixion. This time I'm not drunk. I hear the rotors of the helicopter landing outside. The jail in this town is pretty small. Just a substation, really. And the only dude on duty is, of course, my friend Sheriff Gramps. He's been grinning at me all day, like something bad's coming. And he's here, because that helicopter outside doesn't belong to the Wyoming law. It's Jordan. Again. Coming to save me from myself, I suppose. The front door swings open. I can see it from my cell, which isn't even locked. And Jordan Wells walks in wearing a navy blue pea coat, $3,000 shoes, and a watch that probably costs more than Gramps makes in a year. He brings a bitter winter wind in with him that sweeps into the little building like a vortex, twirling loose papers around, lowering the temperature by 10 degrees immediately. He slams the door closed behind him, and the bits of papers settle on the floor. Gramps looks pissed off about that. I watch through one cracked eye as Jordan takes the place in, tracking everything like he's a goddamn detective or something, and then his gaze rests on me. Can you give us a minute, Jake? Gramps, who must go by the name of Jake, nods, shrugs on his coat, grabs a pack of smokes off his desk, takes a package from Jordan as he heads out the door, probably a bribe, once again evoking the wind that stirs things up before it settles them down. Why am I such a fuck-up? I say, not even bothering to sit up as Jordan enters my cell. Just my natural talent, I guess. You bash that guy's new truck in? Again? No, I correct him. This is the first time I've bashed in the new one. I laugh at my joke. It's not fucking funny, asshole. He's not letting you off this time. Gonna press charges. Why the fuck do you do this shit? Because, I say, when I got home from Denver, I remembered why I did it the first time. And why was that? Jordan is seething with anger. Nobody asked him to come up here, so I don't really give a fuck. Because he beats the fuck out of his wife, I say. And this time he did it in public, in front of me. And no one in that stupid town wanted to interfere because he employs most of them out at the feedlot he owns. That asshole only stopped hitting her when I bashed in his brand new headlights on his brand new truck. So fuck him. He got what he deserved. And if he wants to press charges, well, I'm more than happy to testify how she ended up at Thermopolis General Hospital last night after he knocked her unconscious. Jordan blinks at me. What? It's a long story that starts with Rachel, the woman's sister, hiring me to kick her brother-in-law's ass that night I got drunk a few weeks back. I was already in the bar, already pretty fucked up, and she had the bat with her, just in case I didn't have a gun, which I did, but took the bat anyway. I got more common sense than that. And it ends with me bashing in his new truck instead of his face. You know, because I probably have killed a guy and murders a long stretch in the pen. Jordan blinks again. Too long, really, I sigh. I mean, I'm looking for a vacation, you know, not a permanent stay. You're fucking crazy, he says, finally finding his voice. Yeah, I sigh. That's what they say. Ixion was the original bad boy of Greek mythology, right? I smile at Jordan's expression, which is a cross between disgust and respect. Might as well live up to the name. You tricked her, he says, referring to Evangeline now. I gave her what she needed. You pretended to be me. Don't bother denying it. She fucking told me the whole story. I let her see what she wanted to see. You're lying. I hold out my hands. A mea culpa gesture. Hey, that's what I do best, right? Get you out of trouble. Maybe I should have gone into law. I didn't ask you to take responsibility for what I did. You didn't have to, Jordan. His name comes out of my mouth with a hiss. You didn't have to. He shakes his head. I'm sorry. How many fucking times can I say it? As many as it takes to mean it. He huffs out a breath of air that's half laugh, half loathing. I did mean it. I stand up so fast, have my hands around his throat so firm, get my face right up in his so quick. The shocked expression is lost on me because we are... I. You're the liar. I seethe. You wanted me because Augustine wanted me. Not you. Me. He pushes me back so hard, I stumble and crash into the wall. I made a mistake, he says. I would have taken responsibility for it. It was a fucking felony, I yell. So what? He yells back. So what? I never asked you. I was your fucking glue, Wells. I held you two together. She never wanted you. She wanted Alexander. He laughs. And look what that got her. Look where she is now. Oh, I know exactly where she is now, asshole. Shella called me two nights before I left Denver, and you know what she told me? Jordan shakes his head. That's not why I brought you home. Bull. Shit! I fucking scream it. I point my finger in his face, using every ounce of self-control I have not to choke the life out of my former best friend. You've been playing a game with me since we were kids. You don't know how to stop. You're a fucking addict, Jordan, and your drug is deceit. He swallows hard, unable to deny it, which just pisses me off even more. You came here to bail me out, why? That's not why, he says. Why? I didn't know she was in Denver until you were already back. You're a fucking liar. You can't stop. You're lying to yourself now. You knew Augustine was in Denver. That she was looking for me. She told Shella. She looked you up the first day she got there. You two had lunch. She asked about me, and you'd already moved in the house when that happened, Ixion. Ask Augustine yourself if you don't believe me. No, I say, shaking my head. Fuck her. And fuck you. It's not her fault. No, I say. It's not. It's my fault for lying to her about you. It's my fault for covering your tracks. For taking your fall. You wanted us, right? Me and you and her. And you thought everything was going to be great. Until you realized she was only there because of me. That's not she wanted Alexander for his stability. And she wanted me because the love we have had, I correct, was pure. You were just part of the game, Jordan. Just another player. And it drove you crazy when she said she was going back to Alexander. So you put those cameras up in my apartment. You filmed us. And then you got caught. And instead of telling her it was you, you let me take the blame. I never asked you. You never had to! I yell it so loud, my head begins to throb. You'd have been charged with a felony. And then what, Jordan? What law degree? What career? What life would you have had? He just stands there, unsure if he should argue his point further. But then he gives up and shakes his head. I only came here to beg you to go to Evangeline's show. That's all. I haven't even talked to Augustine since that first day she contacted me. Evangeline asked me to talk to you. She asked for your phone number, but I didn't want to give it without my consent. I sneer. And then I laugh. You know what the worst part is? I ask him. I'm fucking sorry, okay? That crash that killed my family. That crash that made me richer than God because I was the only one left to inherit the family money. Ixion, he whispers. But I keep going, because there's no stopping me now. I've been holding this in for years. That crash happened before I could tell my father the truth. So my entire family, my mother, my father, my baby sister, they all died thinking I was a sick fucking voyeur. That I made a sex tape with Augustine without her consent, and then sent it to Alexander to try to break him and Augustine up for good. I'm sorry, he whispers again. I'm fucking sorry. I didn't even get to go to the funeral because I was in jail. I'm not screaming now. It hurts too much to do anything more than whisper that last part. She only dropped the charges because she felt sorry for me. Just tell me how I can fix it, Ix. Fix it? I laugh. You can't bring people back from the dead, Jordan. There is no do-over for death. And you know what the most ironic part about all this shit is? Alexander knew, you dumbass. He knew what we were doing. So your plan made no sense. She just never loved you. I know that, he says. I don't know why I did it. You did it because you still believe that bullshit. Total exposure, right? That's the little nickname you gave Evangeline's gang. It's such a brass balls move. A slap in the face. All I can do is laugh. Get the fuck out of here. And don't ever look me up again. Jordan lets out a long breath of air. Defeat. I think that was him admitting defeat. Good. He lost his fucking game. Finally. He's getting exactly what he deserves. He turns away, his back to me, but stands there for a few seconds, just shaking his head. You saved her, he says. Yeah, I growl. I did. Not your stupid game. It was me who saved Evangeline. I was the one who helped her, not you. He glances over his shoulder at me, eyes narrowed, frowning. And who the fuck do you think sent you to her, Ixion? What? Me, he says. I'm not what you think. He leaves my cell, crosses the small sheriff's station, opens the door, lets the wind in, and then walks out of my life. Gramps, aka Jake, enters a few minutes later, stirring up the room one more time. But instead of going back to his desk, he comes into my cell and hands me the book. Where'd you get this? I ask, staring at the black cover in his outstretched hand. He nods his head to the door, indicating Jordan. He slipped it to me when I left you two alone. And then he sets it down on the cot. You know, he says, sighing deeply, like he's been doing this job way too long. You're not even under arrest, son. Dude's getting charged with attempted murder this time. You can just go home. You played your part, Ixion. We'll handle it from here. I played my part, all right. The low thrum of helicopter rotors shakes the ceiling. Gramps and I stare at each other until the noise fades, and then he says, go to the show. What? He nods at the book. I was bored outside, so I read it. What? You asshole. She needs you, he says. Then he shrugs one last time before turning his back to me. And you need her, too. I stare at the book and give in because there's not a chance in hell I wouldn't read what she has to say. I pick it up, settle back down in the cot, and open it up to the last entry. Have you ever felt adored? Not for your talent, but because you struck a chord that resonated like light in the night. Held in the gaze of a stranger totally exposed, completely enclosed, tightly embracing the danger one feels when they are loved. But through it all you find that you are more than they defined, and there is something bright like light in the night for the years ahead. I have felt adored, Ixion. And of all the people on this earth, only you were able to do that. That's why I'm here. Jordan has added something to the book as well. A VIP pass to Evangeline's show tonight.
Chapter 47. Evangeline. Mei Ling Chao is standing in my living room. I am due to leave for my first performance since I was a teenager in 20 minutes, but I don't care if I'm late. Mei Ling Chao is standing in my living room. Can I get you some tea? I ask. She looks ill. I know she has cancer, so that's probably most of it, but she looks nervous, too. And please, I say, motioning to the nearest chair, sit. She has a large package with her, which she holds onto tightly, almost lovingly. But she lowers herself into the chair and smiles at me, keeping the package in her lap. Yes, I'd love some tea. Thank you. One sec, okay? I say. I'm reluctant to leave her. Like, if I take my eyes off her, she might wither away to nothing. I'm fine, dear, she says in her old grandmotherly voice. Go. Make the tea. I'll still be here. Okay, I say, wiping my sweaty hands on my dress, then immediately regretting that decision, since this is what I'm wearing on stage in less than an hour. I'll be right back. My whole body hums like it's been charged with electricity as I make my way into the kitchen. My heart is racing, and I feel a little out of breath. A little bit like the old days when I'd start to get a panic attack, but that's not what this is. I'm not panicking. I'm nervous for the performance and excited, too, because ever since that night I played for Ixion, the music has returned. It came home to me that night and filled me up and changed my life. Again. My hands shake as I make tea, wondering what this new feeling really is. Then I realize it's awe. Mei Ling Chao is in my home. When I've got the teapot and cups on a serving tray, I take them back out to the living room and set it down on the coffee table. I smile at her as I pour her cup, and she helps herself to honey and milk as I pour one for myself, too. When was the last time I had a guest in my house? God, I don't even remember. Maybe never. And Lucinda pounding on my door demanding entry doesn't count. You're my first guest ever, I tell her as I take my seat on the couch. Am I? She laughs. Well, it's an honor, my dear. I don't know why I feel like crying, but I'm very close to tears. No, I say. I'm the one who's honored. Truly, this is the best moment of my life. Just seeing you. And right before I take this huge leap back into the life I thought was over, it's... I shake my head and can't continue. You're going to be spectacular tonight, she whispers. I nod and then the tears are there, welling up in my eyes and threatening to break through. I have a seat right up front. You do? I ask. Mei Ling, practically on her deathbed, has traveled 1,000 miles to see me play. Something she can do just as well as I can, and she came anyway. She's here for me. I bought my ticket the moment they went on sale, she says. I had my nephew on the internet, ready to purchase at midnight. Tears are welling up in her eyes now, too. I always knew you'd be back, Evangeline, and that's why I've been keeping this for you. She holds up the package in her arms and presents it to me. I take it out of instinct, pulling it into my lap and just staring at her, unable to understand what's happening. It's missed you, she says. And that's when I realize what this is, what I'm holding. Before I even rip the paper off, before I open the case and see my most prized possession for the first time since I sold it all those years ago. The one thing that saved me when I was living through my darkest moment, desperate for money and freedom. My Stradivarius. I shake my head, tears flowing freely down my cheeks now. I spent almost all my money on it, but it was worth it. I knew you'd be back. I take the violin out, carefully, so very, very carefully, and then I realize what she just said. I can't possibly take this, I say. I can't pay you for it. I'm broke, too. You should sell it, I say. It's priceless, Mei Ling. She laughs. It's a sweet laugh, one I wish I had heard more. It's already been paid for, she says. What? I whisper. Who? Who bought it? It was bought for you, dear. It was an anonymous sale. I don't know who actually paid for it, and I wouldn't have sold it to anyone if they hadn't mentioned it was a gift and I could present it to you myself. But it's been paid for, so don't you worry about me. I've already set up trusts for my sisters and their families with the money. They will all be taken care of after I'm gone, thanks to your secret benefactor. I don't know what to say. I just sit in my living room, with a living legend I have admired and emulated my entire life, and weep. She gets up, hard as it is with her health and age, and walks over to the couch to sit down next to me. She holds me as I cry, strokes my hand, pets my hair, assures me everything is going to turn out just fine. Mothers me, and I cry harder.
Chapter 48 Ixion. I charter a jet to Denver. It takes me several hours to get myself together and drive out to the airstrip in Sheridan, so I don't arrive in the city until almost 7 p.m. I get to the Performing Arts Center in downtown a few minutes after 8. But there's no music yet, Was she waiting for me? So they let me in the doors, clutching my VIP pass in my hand, and direct me to the stairs because I have a balcony seat. I expect Jordan to be there, at least, or Lucinda. But it's a private box, so I take my seat just as the lights